The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky, and on this week's podcast, we'll be looking at the latest volatile happenings in the world of cybersecurity as William Hague admits that the Foreign Office was infected by the Zeus malware late last year, and the notorious hacker group Anonymous takes on another enemy. Is mob rule the future of protest? We'll find out. Joining me to talk through the biggest issues in the technology scene are Jemima Kish, The Guardian's digital media correspondent, and Charles Arthur, The Guardian's technology editor. Now, my website was hacked this week, which was very exciting. I feel like I've arrived. So clearly there's something in the air. Have either of you ever been subject to some kind of cyber attack?
Oh, Free Our Data was hacked a year or so ago. And Sir Alan Sugar, actually, he tried to do a denial of email service on me.
On you, specifically?
On me, specifically.
And how?
When I worked at The Independent, a piece appeared with my name on, which suggested that the Amstrad emailer...
Was a piece of shit?
Well, we didn't quite use that phrase.
I think we used the word
flop. And Sir Alan, or actually, no, Lord Sir Alan Sugar. Lord Professor Sir Alan Sugar, as I think we're required to refer to him, sent out an email to everyone who owned an emailer saying, hey, this guy's just, you know, dissed. Sorry, I colloquialize. The emailer, you know, send him an email, here's his email address, and tell him what you think of him in it. And so
you
I
had,
came,
like,
I'd
email.
Been away on that on holiday, and I got about 1,000 emails. But the interesting thing was ploughing through them and finding that not everyone loved the emailer.
There's more shakeups in the corporate tech world as mobile phone giants Nokia shift power at the top and make new alliances behind the scenes. We'll also bring you a sneak preview of next week's Mobile World Congress. Plus, we'll dissect what the announcements from Sky and O2 about what their plans are to dominate the Wi-Fi and public areas mean for the future of web surfing in the country's cafes. But the big story this week is sex. With a world of kinks at our fingertips, what is the web really doing to our sexual attitudes and behaviors? We talk with Professor Fiona Atwood from Sheffield Hallam University and author of the book Porn.com, and Kyle Mahoulis, the world's leading expert on teledildonics. And if you don't know what they are, keep listening to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the next 30 minutes to find out more. We'll start with this week's news. Several developments in high-profile hacking cases have hit the headlines this week. First, the head of the U.S. security firm H.B. Gary was targeted by the hacktivist community Anonymous on Sunday. Aaron Barr's Twitter account was hijacked, and messages coming from the group claimed that they had access to his email addresses and other personal details of the firm's employees. Now, Charles, why was he hacked?
Well, he said that he had infiltrated Anonymous. He said that he had found the identities of some of the people who were movers and shakers within the group, and that he was preparing to name some of them. There was a suggestion that he might be looking to give the names to the FBI, that he might be looking to perhaps sell them even to the FBI. And Anonymous took exception to this it's a bit like sort of anthropomorphization. You know, it's sort of describing Anonymous as having a view is not quite the way that it works. It really is like a flock of birds. You know, you don't say the flock of birds says, hey, I know, let's fly to Africa and let's go to this particular place. They just say, okay, let's fly south.
Well, it's interesting you say that because people have said that there is no hierarchy in Anonymous, and so therefore, what was he going to reveal? He was going to reveal some members' details?
Well, but the thing about Anonymous is that there are different levels of skills within it. So there are people who are, you know, very accomplished hackers. There are people who are simply along for the ride. There are people who've just joined and say, hey, where do we go hack now? And the thing is that I think he thought, that the head of HP Gary, Aaron Barr, thought he was going to find, you know, name some of the people who are at or near the top, the ones who basically are leading the flock. Not clear whether he did, because the people who he had named in the system, because the site got hacked, all the emails were out, the names are out there. Those people say they didn't. Well, okay, it becomes a sort of his word against theirs sort of situation. But it's clear that there are some people with hacking chops there because they're able to break into his website.
Well, there are parallels, actually, with Anonymous's attack on the legal firm ACS Law. They shut up shop last week, actually. Now, Charles, are Anonymous's actions to H.B. Gary, to Aaron Barr, are they related to the ACS Law's closure in any way? Are their motives for attacking Aaron Barr the same?
Anonymous, in that situation, went after ACS Law because they didn't like the tactics. They thought that it's against a free internet.
But, of course, their motivation seemed, well, the outcome seems to have been
the outcome is exactly the same, because ACS Law had his emails and other details spilled all over the net, sure.
Jemima.
Yeah, I was just loving the comments that were on this story that was on our site about this. Efrain Gatsby posted a bear that took up about sort of 6 inches of the screen. It was brilliant. Halsey said, the revolution won't be televised, it will be uploaded. And then Whizgiggle pointed out that the statement that Anonymous put on the front of H.B. Gary's website that said, "You're nothing compared to Anonymous. You have little to no security knowledge. Your business thrives off charging ridiculous prices for simple things like Nmaps, and you don't deserve praise or even recognition as security experts." Expose the charlatans for what they are.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because the apparently impervious Anonymous Collective did in fact receive a blow last week when several of its members were arrested in connection with the pre-Christmas attacks on PayPal, MasterCard and other organizations who reneged on their support of the WikiLeaks website. Now, Charles, what's the latest on this?
The police in the US and in Holland and in the UK have made a number of arrests. It's about a dozen in all, and people have been bailed. Basically, the suggestion is that these are people possibly with less of the hacking skills, less of the ability to hide their tracks than some of the other ones, such as the people who would have attacked ACS Law and H.B. Gary. So the police just take a long time to decide whether they're going to prosecute, gather the evidence. So it's all going to go underground for a while.
But the hacking stories have this week even reached the state level, as there was evidence that was revealed that the U.S. and Israeli governments had collaborated on the development of the Stuxnet worm that we reported on last year. That took down an Iranian nuclear power facility. William Hague also admitted at a conference in Munich that the Foreign Office's own network had been infiltrated by a malicious virus late in 2010. Now, the Foreign Secretary at that point called for an international code of conduct to be adopted between governments. And, you know, that is interesting when you think about how different governments are going to deal with people like Anonymous, people in Anonymous, or even, you know, these more organized hackers. Now, Charles, what can you tell us about these revelations, both about Stuxnet and about Zeus?
Well, the Stuxnet one is interesting because the head of Iran's atomic energy organization said that there should be an investigation into it, even though it had absolutely no effect on the Bashir nuclear plant, which is what it was targeting. One sort of suspects that he wouldn't really be calling for an investigation if it had no effect. The evidence is that it was tested in Israel on a nuclear plant there, because Israel has, you know, not only nuclear plants but also nuclear arms, and that's the reason why it's, you know, the US and Israel connection comes up, is that this was reckoned to be a far more effective way of targeting the Bushehr plant, where Iran is reckoned to be purifying uranium in order to make a nuclear weapon.
Jemima, what effect do you think that this kind of collaboration, this alleged collaboration between the US and Israel on this type of computer hacking is going to have on international public diplomacy?
Well, William Hague trying to initiate a global set of standards and agreements, almost like a sort of convention of not human rights but sort of cyber rights.
It's sort of like a Warsaw Convention,
you know,
isn't it?
What does he go to the US first? You know, traditionally what's the diplomatic expression? You know, they're a special ally, aren't they?
Partners in crime.
Yeah, partners in crime. He's desperately ambitious with this, I think. I mean, not only does a lot of the most interesting and naughty activity come out of people that aren't affiliated with government and won't take any notice of any kind of convention like that, but terrorism is clearly going to be exploiting this area more and more. And look at the principles that he's looking at establishing with this. Mm. Some of those are tolerance, free expression, intellectual property. I mean, good luck negotiating those with Russia, who incidentally just kicked out one of our journalists for reporting WikiLeaks into Putin's mafia state.
And speaking of WikiLeaks, the US as well, their stance on openness has come under quite a lot of fire given their response to the WikiLeaks incident.
I mean, but I suppose you could see them hammering out something a bit like the Warsaw Convention, you know, which relates to prisoners of wars and so on and the conduct of war. That you wouldn't target essential medical facilities, that you wouldn't target, you know, things that you could agree with.
Is that
be
for
essential.
The US to ignore?
Well,
it could only ever be an aspirational thing, can't it? I mean, then clearly.
Yeah, but the Warsaw Convention is a bit like that. And if you ignore it, then you can be done for war crimes.
Guantanamo Bay. So,
yeah.
Well, also in the news this week, Nokia's chief executive, Stephen Elop, is planning a shakeup of the executive team at the mobile giant, which, Charles, you suggested in an article this week is because of behind-the-scenes deals with software giant Microsoft. What's the story here?
Well, Stephen Elop came from Microsoft, where he was in charge of the Office division. He joined Nokia in September of last year after the board kicked out its previous chief executive, who basically they didn't see as having the right approach to pilot it through the big changes that are coming in smartphones and mobile devices. And Nokia's just announced that for the fourth quarter, its share of the smartphone market fell, even though it's still got the largest. As a single vendor, it's got the largest market, but Android actually surpassed it in terms of the number of units shipped. So Nokia has a problem, and it's a growing problem. And the question is, you know, Symbian just doesn't have any traction. And Elop said as much himself in an analyst call. He said, you know, we just don't seem to have the right ecosystems. We need to create or join working ecosystems. Now, the choices, he's going to be making an announcement on Friday, an analyst meeting, I'm going to be there, about where Nokia is going to go. Now, there's some suggestions this morning that he's actually going to uproot the executive team and take them over to Silicon Valley, just move the whole executive team, although the research and development team would stay behind in Tampere in Finland.
Well, they described that as a virtual HQ, didn't they?
Yeah. Not sure what that really means. I mean, well, I would have thought it makes more sense just to have the execs in Finland.
That would be a phenomenally big change for Nokia, though. I mean, the biggest for about 150 years or something since they changed from being a paper mill.
But the suggestion is that Elop is going to announce some sort of tie-up with another platform. Now, the question is really, what platforms are they? You're not going to go with Apple because they're an enemy. RIM's an enemy. You're not going to go with HP or Palm because just a bit too small. It's a bit untried. Why would you go with HP? Which leaves really Windows Phone 7, which is Microsoft, who might know a couple of people there, or Android. The trouble with Android being that there's tons of other people out there. You're going to get undercut by Chinese manufacturers. You can't differentiate, although HTC tries to with its Sense UI. And also there's the possibility of patents. And I would have thought that Elop, having come from Microsoft, is going to be very aware of patent litigation risk that's involved in Android because Oracle is suing them. So my reading is that it's going to go for Windows Phone 7.
Now, this is, I'm sure, all going to be discovered and revealed in Mobile World Congress next week. Tell us what you're looking forward to seeing other than and hearing other than these types of announcements, Charles.
Well, Andy Rubin of Google is going to be doing some talking there. So I'm really interested to know what the forward path is for Android. You know, does he think that actually now they're the biggest platform that they've done enough? Is there, in effect, a sort of forking? Because you now have Android 3.0, which is built for tablets. So does that mean the 2.x branch is now the phones branch and the 3.0 is the tablets branch?
Is that Honeycomb?
Honeycomb is okay. 3.0, yeah. It would be good to get a release date on Honeycomb because no one I know can give any sort of release date for it. Motorola is going to be giving dates, we think, for the shipping of its Zoom tablet. That's spelled XOOM. The question again is about pricing, because there's been some suggestion in the States that it's going to cost $800 for a 10-inch Zoom running Honeycomb. Now, when you compare that to the iPad, it's a fair whack more. Are you really getting that much more for it? Is that really going to be what it is? And actually, the other problem is the app ecosystem. Are there that many apps written for Honeycomb? Don't think so yet.
Well, we will have a full report from Mobile World Congress in a fortnight on Tech Weekly. Finally, technology company GoGo has announced a $30 million investment recently, making a total of $500 million for their in-flight Wi-Fi technology. The company, which started in 2008, brings broadband to customers at 35,000 feet. I sound like an ad, don't I? Allowing web addicts like me to feed the addiction in the last connection-free preserve on or off Earth. So, Jemima, what's the latest on this?
So this is on about, well, at least seven US airlines now. So this is a US domestically focused service. It's got quite a lot of attention because although customers or passengers can pay in air, they've done a couple of sponsored deals. So Google during the Christmas holidays sponsored free access, clearly had a lot more people using it. And Ford are sponsoring free Facebook access, which is the most commonly accessed site at the moment through that's what people want to do on planes, apparently. And there's an Instat analyst who said that 7 to 10% of passengers are prepared to pay for Wi-Fi data. So it's a very promising business.
It certainly is, and especially for the airlines, it sounds like it's quite a promising business because then they don't have to get into movie deals, music deals.
And they don't have to pay to install expensive TVs and systems on the plane.
And so ultimately this is a win-win, as they say in the business lingo,
yes.
for the airlines. So that clearly is why there's so much money behind this.
That is good. And I also looked at the way it worked because I'm like that. And fairly straightforward. They just have a local network on the plane and then that connects to the ground either through satellite. And there's a little picture that I've been looking at of a little kind of nodule on the top of the plane, which is the transmitter. And that connects to the ground either... No, it's on the top because it goes up to a satellite.
Aerodynamic.
And they're up rather than down. Or EVDO, which is the way that planes communicate. It's the kind of cell network for planes inside the US. I haven't been able to find anyone in the UK that's doing it yet, though, or transatlantic flights, but keep an eye on that. But more importantly, do we really want Wi-Fi on planes?
Yeah,
this is really the question. It can be done, but should it be done? Isn't it just that last precious little...
Absolutely.
...uncontactable space that we should
keep? That in the tube. Yeah. So you can actually get work done without being distracted by checking your Facebook and saying, you know, status updates. I'm on a plane!
Need to be able to go offline. If that has to be forced, then so be it.
In related news, Sky has just bought the Wi-Fi service, the Cloud, and I am trying very hard to think of an amusing pun to do with airplanes, Sky, and the Cloud, but I'm a really awful headline writer. That's why I leave it all to the subs. So if you can come up with one, do let us know at GuardianTW on Twitter. But seriously, Sky's acquisition has taken the media provider to new heights. See where I went with that? Stealing the thunder. Yes, from O2, who offered their customers free access to the cloud services when out and about. Now, Charles, why has Sky done this? How much does this have to do with mobile trends? Things like the fact that, you know, accessing webmail has gone down in the past quarter, primarily because people are accessing their web through their mobile or their emails through their mobile devices and things like that. How much of that do you think has to do with the motivations behind Sky's decision?
I think Sky is doing a big strategic plan. They now have they'll offer a phone service, they'll offer a broadband service, they offer TV. I think that they're just trying to build out so that they're pervasive, so they're not just a content provider, they're a network provider as well. And it's not a simple answer, I don't think.
Well, speaking of O2, they've actually responded to the sale of the cloud to Sky by announcing their own Wi-Fi network. Jemima, what are their plans? Do you know?
They've launched free Wi-Fi across the country, largely to take the pressure off their 3G networks. And obviously, it's much faster to access stuff through Wi-Fi. I have to say, I am really worried about Rupert Murdoch being in our datas looking at everything that we do, but that's probably for another time.
Well, keep on top of these stories and more at guardian.co.uk/technology. I've had sex on the brain for a fortnight. And not just because we're coming up to Valentine's Day. Yes, Jemima, I am a cynic. But because last Sunday's Untangling the Web column in the Observer New Review was all about it. What, I asked, consumers, producers, and people who think about this kind of thing has changed in our real lives because of the, frankly, obscene amount of sex that we can access with the click of a mouse. Well, one of the contributors to this column was Professor Fiona Atwood from Sheffield Hallam University and editor of a recent book called Porn.com. She joined us now on the phone. 1 in 10 websites feature sexual content. That's a pretty high proportion. So what effect is this actually having on our attitudes and our behaviours to sex offline?
I'm not sure we know what effects it's having, but I think what we can certainly see is a huge opening up of different ways of talking about sex, thinking about sex, finding out about sex, and even having sex. And I think perhaps we need to move away from that idea that the online will have an effect on the offline and start looking at the way that those two things are all becoming part of the same thing. They're all ways of having sex.
But has it had an effect, given that so much of it, you know, so much of the online sex, at least in my sort of opinion, as you know, not particularly a purveyor of
academic
these
academic experience,
certainly, almost. Certainly, yes. But I imagine, and I think the public's imagination about the online content is that it's you know, it's full of kinks, it's full of fetishes, it's full of you know, dark behaviors, things that aren't particularly vanilla experiences of sexual behaviors. Surely this has had some kind of effect on our relationship to sex and our relationship to each other.
Well, there's very little evidence to tell us in a measurable way. I think you can see that. You can see a kind of impact in the way that other media talk about sex. So it's become quite commonplace for sex advisors and sex advice books to discuss kinks, discuss using media as part of sexual relationships. It's become much more easy to sort of think about it and talk about it. But the extent to which people actually then go off and do that, we really don't know.
What would you say are some of the downsides of the online sexual content, given that, you know, as you say, that we don't actually have we don't have any evidence that it's changing our behaviors, but people do perceive that it might. So, for example, recently there was a documentary on the BBC looking at the sexualization of children. And arguably they said that, you know, the online content was sexualizing our young men, our British young men more. Is there any evidence to support this? Are there downsides of the sexual content online?
There's no reliable evidence on the downsides. If you look at it historically, there is a kind of recurring worry, particularly around young people, every time there's a development in technology that means that people have more access to sex. But I think the way that we respond to that is really important. So, for example, today there's been a new advert that's come out around the perils of sexting, which is young people using technology to, you know, for example, send pictures to each other. And this advert focuses exclusively on the act of the girl in sending an image to her boyfriend as a big, terrible mistake that basically destroys her whole life. But what's actually involved in that, what makes that a problem or what gives it a downside, is the fact that she's bullied by her peers. She starts to worry about future employment. She's worried about what her dad says and so on. Those are the downsides of the way people might start to use technology. It's kind of in the reactions to other people around them, I think. So I think we need to put a lot less emphasis on what people are actually doing to engage with sex online, and much more emphasis on the kinds of negative outcomes that they're made to suffer as a result of doing that. Bullying's still just bullying.
But surely, the thing with the sexting is that there's no, you know, she having sent the text doesn't have any control about what happens to it afterwards. And that is the big difference, isn't it? That's one difference in the sort of the personal technologies, is that if you send someone an email, you can't guarantee that it won't go further on and out of your control and be reproduced and spread around the world in a way that never used to happen on previous technologies.
I think, it would happen, but it would be more localised, wouldn't it? You could never really control what somebody did with an image you gave to them of yourself. But now, of course, and it's not just about sex, every kind of indiscretion can go round the globe very quickly because of social networking. But again, I think that's an issue. It's not necessarily about sex, is it? It's about the way that technology opens up new ways of doing things, and it means we have to get to grips with that. But I think the worst kind of response is to focus again on, you know, blaming the sexual activity, and particularly blaming the girl. It becomes a way of, it's very like blaming girls for wearing short skirts or something, rather than looking at people's attitudes to them for doing that.
Some might argue that because of the networked aspect of the technology, the web in particular, but also, you know, mobile phones and other communication devices, we're able to develop strong communities. We're able to develop trusting relationships because we're connecting person to person. And this is something that's quite different from our other media consumption of sexual content, you know, traditional porn has either been, you know, a magazine or a film. And so, Fiona, could you even say that because we are interacting, we have the potential to interact with another human being on the other end of a network technology, the web itself is the ultimate sex toy?
I think it becomes a kind of point. It's where everything blurs, isn't it? It's no longer the thing that we receive or consume, it becomes the thing we're using. So it becomes a mode of communication. And yes, it becomes a toy. It becomes the tool, it's probably the wrong term, for whatever people want to make it. So yes, I would say it is the ultimate sex toy.
Well, speaking of the ultimate sex toy, one of the people whom I spoke with for the column, whose contribution didn't make the final cut, was Kyle Mahulis. By day, he works at a robotics company that does DARPA-ish things like cars that drive themselves and giant scale mapping. But in his spare time, he is the leading expert on teledildonics, or sex toys that are connected to the web. So when I spoke to him, I asked for his description of what teledildonics is.
The word teledildonics was coined in the 1970s. And really what it means is mechanical sex toys that are driven and controlled by a computer over a network, so that you'll have some sort of interface on your computer that will allow you to control speed or movement or something like that of someone else's hardware, and they will be somewhere on the other end of the network and be able to use the toy that you are currently controlling.
What elements of the technologies are involved in the production of teledildonics?
Just about anything I can think of, actually. That's the fun part in terms of experimenting with this. It's anytime I get a new sensor, be it, for instance, Microsoft's new Kinect camera, you can always find some way to try and add it to a situation involving teledildonics. Because what we're trying to do is make the toy both usable and, more importantly, comfortable to use. A lot of people are very scared of their computer. And honestly, if you don't want to install your printer, there's a good chance you probably don't want to actually be intimate with that hardware also. So we've got this problem to figure out of how do we make people comfortable enough to use these things through different sensors, through different interfaces. And once we do that, what can we learn from that and take back to the rest of computing and user interfaces?
It's been quite an iterative process, I imagine, from the 70s until now. Can you describe some of the highlights, some of the key pieces, the prototypes that have evolved into more comfortable and more attractive technologies over the years?
With the advent of the web and the more popular internet, we had products like the Safe Sex Plus. Things really started to pick up in 2005 to 2007. That's when we started seeing a lot more toys released in terms of like rabbit vibrators that could be controlled via the internet. And another popular control mechanism was to embed information into adult movies, that whenever you played the movie back, it would also have enough information to control a toy based on whatever was happening in the movie. The idea is sound. The problem comes from the fact that none of the toys are a very good replica of what's happening on screen. So while you are certainly watching like real sex happen or whatever else, what is happening to you haptically usually doesn't exactly feel like that. So there's a bit of a disconnect in terms of what's happening on screen and what's happening to you. It's sort of the uncanny valley of haptics.
And what would you say that people are really seeking in their experiences? I mean, there's the obvious that people are seeking, but is it more about the immersion? Is it about the sensation of the touch, the feel? What is it that they're seeking in their experience?
I'm not sure people actually realize what they're seeking versus what they think they're seeking. But usually the most successful toys, no matter what kind of interaction they use or control they use, as long as they hook you up to another person that you are wanting to play with, that's really where the popularity comes in. People are really looking to establish a connection with another person. A lot of the solo play toys, they're semi-popular, but when you look at teledildonics, you're looking at trying to get two people in remote places to be intimate with each other. And that's really the most important part. If you have a very good connection to the other, emotionally, mentally, to the other to the person on the other side, then the toy can be the cheapest vibrator in the world, but thanks to emotions and brain chemistry and everything else, it's going to feel great.
When I said to one of my colleagues that we were going to have a conversation, she said, that's fascinating because to me it seems as if it's the antithesis of what most people consider intimacy. You know, why would you mediate your sexual encounters via the web? Wouldn't the ultimate objective be to get together and, you know, to get it on?
I guess the answer to that is just yes. The community is all over the place. We've heard of people just wanting to work with programs only, and more importantly, have sort of AI built on the other side that they knew was AI but was still acting like a person. There's actually, for instance, programs that you can get that are sort of virtual dominatrixes that will programmatically dominate you. But that's a very certain segment of the population. Between couples, it's great because if you're traveling a lot, you have the ability to be intimate just using the network, which it's augmented just like phone sex is. So you're adding a couple more elements in that make it a little bit more intimate, but it's certainly not going to replace actual physical, real contact intimacy at any point soon, if ever. Our brains just really, I don't believe, are wired that way.
People will see this and do see this as very much a niche interest. I'm curious as to what the response is of people who aren't au fait, who aren't open to this kind of intimate experience. What is their response to your line of work, to what it is that you do?
Oh, well, I pretty much purely exist in the realm of the loser to them. It's very much seen as, well, why would you ever do that if you could have other people? You're wasting your time there. Go out and find someone. So on and so forth. Which is really not the case because this isn't really built for that kind of interaction.
How do you think teledildonics have shaped and transformed our attitudes to sex and our sexualities offline?
It's continued the idea that we can be intimate without being right next to each other. And it's sort of sped up the communications mechanism for doing that. If you look back into 19th century, where we have the long and flowing love letter that may have taken weeks or months to get somewhere, then we move into telegraph, telephone. Like, we've just been, just like everything else, speeding up the communications mechanism. And along with that, with teledildonics, we're starting to add haptics. Instead of just being able to see and hear, now you can feel. And it may not actually be really what it would feel like if the other person was there, but even the fact that you're feeling anything is powerful enough to make the situation more immersive.
That was Kyle McCoolis from slashdong.org. Jemima, you were that colleague that I referred to in that interview.
I don't know, maybe it's because I'm English. I feel like such a prude. But yes, it's just so far from my relationship with sex and my I don't know how I feel sex should be. It's a physical, intimate, real-world thing, and I can't imagine mediating a relationship, as you said, through, you know, what are effectively just bits of plastic. And, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Charles?
Drew, I'm with Jemima on this one.
We are both left cold. I've never even done online dating, for God's sake, you know.
So, Fiona, have we witnessed a new community discovering these types of things? Or are people like Jemima and Charles in the minority? Are people more open to these ideas now?
I think in different forms, people have been doing this kind of thing for a while. I mean, not necessarily with toys or machines, but if you think of people having cyber sex simply by describing, by typing what they're doing, people were doing that, you know, a very long time ago. It's a very sort of primitive form of online technological sex. But it's the same principle, getting close to somebody but not being able to touch them and perhaps not even knowing who they are. So I think more and more we're doing things like that. We're finding new ways of being intimate. And I think it's part of the same class of things of, you know, now friendship can be entirely online, and as Jemima just mentioned, dating can at least start online.
But there's a difference, surely. You know, friendship online, you know, everyone knows that that, you know, you can have an email conversation with someone, you can tweet with someone, you can get an idea of what the person is like. But it's not the same as meeting them in real life and saying, oh, okay, so you have coffee like that. Oh, okay, and all the body language, all those things that follow, and yeah, the stuff about people on IRCs back in the 90s, I think it was, you know. It's surely that sort of people who have either a problem with intimacy or else who are embarrassed or have a lot of difficulty in admitting to themselves about, you know, their sexuality. I mean, I seem to recall a lot of the situations where you had people who were looking for gay relationships, but they didn't want to admit to themselves, perhaps in some ways, that they were gay.
I think that cuts both ways. I think on the one hand, certainly it's allowed people who wouldn't be able to express themselves or wouldn't be able to have intimate relationships to do that because of the anonymity.
But is it intimate?
So, yes, I think it is intimate. I think it's a different kind of intimate. And I think it's just in the same way that you can talk about a community where you have to have physical proximity, like you have to live in a village or something. But you can also have online communities where people feel very connected to each other and may never meet. Again, it's just about an expansion of that term, and I think community, friend, sex, lover can come in different forms and involve different levels of you know, physicality, so virtuality.
So it's almost like a redefinition then of sex, isn't it? You know, it's not the sort that Jane Austen would be able to recognise if you said, well, I'm in Australia and, you know, and she's in London, but hey, we're having sex.
I don't think she ever had sex.
Well, okay, but but this is the sort of thing, isn't it? Is that you're having to almost redefine the word, or else maybe it sort of needs a new word for it, which possibly we haven't come up with yet.
Possibly, but then I think, you know, maybe Jane Austen wrote steamy letters. People have always used other things to communicate and feel close to each other, not necessarily using their bodies. But I think it is different, it is novel, but there's always something you can link it back to and think, well, people have already been doing that in some form or another.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a woman with a computer is in need of a teledildonic machine. No, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because this does raise all kinds of issues about whether we are problematizing people online, whether we are dealing with intimacy and communities online. Many thanks, Fiona, for bringing up all of these issues. And you can read more about the web's effects on our sexual attitudes and hear more of Kyle's interview, including what his goal is for teledildonics, why women are the primary beneficiary of the technology, and why it hasn't broken through to wide acceptance at guardian.co.uk/untanglingtheweb. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our guest, Fiona Atwood, and to our regulars, Charles and Jemima. Next week, Jemima and I report from the Guardian South by Southwest hack taking place this weekend here at King's Place. We hear all the crazy ideas that come from a meeting of the minds between geeks and journalists in our valiant effort to identify and potentially implement the best way to cover a sprawling event like South by Southwest. The producer this week was Scott Colley. I'm Alex Krotowski. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.